It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over the last year, Pittsburgh International Airport saw increased passenger traffic, additional flights, some airlines calling it quits, at least for now, and progress toward a billion-dollar makeover of the terminal. Joining us is the CEO of the Allegheny County Airport Authority, Christina Kasotis, who, like a lot of us today, stuck in the snowy traffic conditions. Christina, thanks for taking the time.
I appreciate your patience. I'm sorry I can't be there in person, but yes, happy to be here talking to you.
All right, Christina. So first off, I want to ask you, a big portion of the airport's workforce, their public-facing workforce, missed two paychecks during the government shutdown. How's everyone doing now that the government is at least temporarily back open?
I think everybody's doing as well as can be expected. They were very grateful to the help that was provided by us and the community to offer a bridge as they showed up for work without getting paid for it. So we were really very grateful to a lot of community partners who stepped in to help out with food and food bank opportunities, and that really made a difference. I would say that we are very lucky. We've always felt that way in terms of our federal partners, and we did not see a major impact to our operations at any point during the shutdown.
Because they stayed on the job.
They stayed on the job. They showed up. They did what was asked of them, and we were just incredibly grateful and still are.
So if I have to be pessimistic, are you confident you can sustain if another shutdown were to hit in a couple of weeks?
Let's get through. Let's take one thing at a time. I am confident that we are as prepared as anyone.
Okay. So 2018 turned out to be Pittsburgh International Airport's busiest in numbers of passengers since, I believe, 2007, nearly 9.7 million. What do you think are the key reasons? More choices, prices, something else?
Well, it's the fact that the airline service is there. People, this community is still underserved. So as we bring in more opportunities for people to get where they want to go and to bring people in from where they want to be coming from nonstop, people will use the service. Connections are not as appealing to people as getting places nonstop. So as we continue to bring in new airline service, then we see people respond by flying. And that's been the result of a whole lot of strategy around which markets make the most sense for Pittsburgh International, which airlines. And so I think that it's a testament to the fact that we're getting it and we're getting better at providing the service that the community needs.
What's more important to you, that nearly 7.5% growth in total numbers this past year, or 32 straight months of growth? In other words, year to year or consistency of increases?
I'd say year to year, because if you might have a dip. You know, we haven't had 32 straight months of the same type of growth. We've had some months at 10%, some months at 3%. What's really important is that overall the trend is upwards, and that it is continuing. The passenger response is a direct answer to the new service. It's yes, we are going to fly it. Yes, this is important to us, and that's what that we you know we've lost some airlines, as you said in the intro. WOW is no longer here. Neither is OneJet, but we're still growing. And what that tells me is that the market is still responding to the service that's here. We got a couple of things haven't worked out, but overall things are working out.
All right. What's your overall approach, your game plan, trying to reach a certain passenger level? I mean, what role does seasonal flights play in that?
It's not. I wouldn't say we're trying to reach a certain passenger level. We're trying to reach a certain air service mix. We're trying to reach a certain mix of flights that and air carriers that fit the market. So there's very much a need for a regional carrier that will serve medium-sized markets like Hartford and Memphis and others. And that's really important to a segment of the business community, but also really important to our community is ultra-low-cost opportunities like on Allegiant, Frontier, and Spirit, as is it is equally important for our major network carriers, American, United, and Delta, JetBlue, Southwest, Alaska. These guys are all filling a very important need for the market. And that's what I'm trying to do, is make sure that the mix of airlines and the mix of markets is exactly right for this community.
More routes, more destinations, more airlines. Mm-hmm. That means more seats. Mm-hmm. But are you filling those seats as quickly as you would like to?
Yes, actually, what we're seeing is that the passenger growth is exceeding the seat growth. So what that tells us is that as we bring in more airlines, say we have, 6% growth in seats 1 month, we'll see an 8% increase in passengers. So, yes, the flights are full. And you've got to remember that the way that the airlines judge success is not just by the number of people on the plane, but by the fare and the yield, what's considered, how much money are they making per mile flown? Everybody's got a different formula. Everybody's got a different break-even point. So it's a combination of the load factor, how many people are on that plane, how full it is, and the yield. And you will see some flights that may not be all the way full that are still very profitable and still very successful for an airline.
You mentioned earlier OneJet and WOW. Despite the increases in passenger traffic, you had to deal with the loss of OneJet. The Airport Authority has sued to recover some of the financial incentives given to OneJet. What's the status of that effort? Can you tell us?
Well, we're in litigation, so I can't go too much into it. But I can tell you that we're absolutely determined to make sure that people understand that if we are going to participate in incentives, we expect that the service commitment will be fulfilled. Otherwise, we expect our money back. So.
Mm-hmm. WOW was another airline that got some incentives. 3 weeks ago, I believe it was, of course, WOW based in Iceland, suspended flights from Pittsburgh International Airport.
Yep.
So the question is there any chance that WOW will resume in Pittsburgh, or is that off the books?
I think there's a great chance that they will. Pittsburgh performed really well for them, but WOW had to return a number, double-digit number of aircraft because they grew too big too fast. So they're in the process of restructuring. They've kept 4 markets in the U.S. and 2 more in Canada. And we didn't make the top, the top 4, but we were very successful for them. We would very much welcome them back. People loved the service, and it fulfilled an important need in the community. So, sure, we'd love to have them back. We just want to make sure that when they come back, they can stay. So we're happy to, to wait while they get healthy, and they're going through a potential acquisition right now. We'll wait to see what happens. But it was a very successful service, and it certainly signaled to the international market, along with Condor, that there is an international market to be served year-round in Pittsburgh. And I think that really played a large part in our ability to bring back British Airways. So I think WOW fulfilled a very important role for us, and we'd be very happy to welcome them back. They were a good partner.
Okay. A lot of excitement was generated when it was announced the $1 billion makeover of the terminal. Some new developments happening later this month regarding sort of an unveiling of some plans?
Yeah, is this February 1st already?
So
yes,
is.
Later this month. God, time flies. Yes, on the 20th, we will be releasing the concept. We will be showing everybody what the concept. This is not design. So I want to be really clear. We're not going to know everything that every path through this new terminal yet. But what this is saying is what basically will this terminal look like? When we released the master plan, we had released a concept that basically was a large triangle sort of nestled in between two terminals. And now we've gone through a design process to say, okay, what should this concept be? Arrivals, departures, roadways, et cetera. We'll be releasing that to the public through Facebook Live and through an event downtown, and then we will start the schematic design process. So by the summer, we'll have a very good idea of what this terminal will look like and how people will move through it.
Right. We're talking about a $1 billion project. That takes some time, but when are you hoping? When are you expecting those first passengers to enter this newly redone terminal?
2023.
Okay. So we're talking
we've got a ways to go. But the good news is for us that we can build while the airport operates without a huge amount of impact to passengers, because we're building on the apron that's already out there. So we've got a lot of work to do in figuring out, you know, how to make sure that we do that in a way that offers the least impact to passengers. But it won't be a situation like LaGuardia where there's a big impact to passengers during construction.
And just a couple of minutes left, Christina. Ground was broken in December on what's being called an innovation campus near Pittsburgh International. Mm-hmm. How will this play into the overall, the big picture out there?
Well, it's very much tied to it. We have a vision of, we have land, and we have land that's in a foreign trade zone. We have land that can take advantage of a lower cost of energy due to a microgrid that we're building. And so we see a real opportunity for some sort of advanced manufacturing data, something that will offer an opportunity for companies that are looking to be in the U.S., in the Midwest, to take advantage of being close to the airport. We see that as, whether it's cargo or people, sort of creating our own demand over time. And we think that there's an opportunity with certain industry clusters that will make sense, and we're exploring that right now.
All right. So why might this succeed when earlier proposals to use this large chunk of land never really came to fruition?
Because we have a whole lot of partners in the community involved in this. This would take advantage of what I would consider to be the community's strength in universities and our past, our manufacturing past, our future in AI and robotics. I think there's a real opportunity to go after an industry cluster that will want to be in Pittsburgh and want to be near the airport. So I would say that it's really a function of time and technology. And I think the time is right for us to be pursuing this. In addition, we've got this ability through the energy in the area and the fact that we drill for it at the airport with this lower cost of energy opportunity that will be attractive, we feel, for some companies.
Christina Kasotis is the CEO of the Allegheny County Airport Authority. Christina, thanks so much for joining us, and safe driving to you out there.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Despite the absence of the Steelers and the Eagles in Sunday's Super Bowl, excitement is brewing in Pennsylvania over the big game. That's because it's the first Super Bowl that people can legally bet on in the state. County Controller Chelsea Wagner is looking to add the voices of county residents to a call to avert the impending final split between healthcare giants UPMC and Highmark. Wagner launched an online petition through which residents can ask state officials to step in last month. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A producer at KDKA-TV was fired this week after airing a Chiron graphic referring to Tom Brady as, quote, known cheater. The station said the graphic didn't adhere to its standards of providing unbiased reporting. In the meantime, a GoFundMe page is seeking $10,000 to donate to the now-out-of-work producer. And Governor Tom Wolf is renewing efforts to raise the state's minimum wage. He's hoping to boost it to $12 an hour this year, which would make it one of the highest in the nation. Pennsylvania's minimum wage has hovered at $7.25 an hour for the last decade. Find more on our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The pressure continues to mount for two members of the Pennsylvania legislature to resign because of accusations of sexual misconduct. Republican Representative Brian Ellis of Butler County, Democratic Senator Dalen Leach of Montgomery County. Reporter Liz Navratil covers the Capitol for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and other publications. Liz, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Liz, remind us briefly, what are Ellis and Leach accused of?
Sure. The Dauphin County DA is investigating an allegation that Representative Ellis sexually assaulted a woman while she was incapacitated in late 2015. And Senator Dalen Leach has been accused of, I'm trying to be careful with how I word this because
yes.
It's a complicated case.
Yes.
But the woman has alleged sexual misconduct by Senator Leach when she was a teenager and he was a lawyer defending her mother in a criminal case.
So that goes years back, doesn't it?
That goes back to the early 1990s.
Okay.
And some of these allegations were raised in the 90s as well.
Mm-hmm. What have their party leaders had to say about these accusations and about the status of Ellis and Leach?
Senator Leach is, so far, it seems, operating fairly normally in the state Senate. Senate Democrats have announced that they have hired an outside law firm to investigate the allegation being alleged against him. And State Representative Brian Ellis is still in the House, but the House Republican leaders have called on him to resign. Whether or not he will do that remains to be seen.
Yes. I understand that GOP leadership removed Ellis from a committee chairmanship. Did that happen as well?
That is my understanding.
Right. So obviously we want to know what the two lawmakers have said, if anything. Have Ellis and Leach responded to these accusations?
I have not seen any public responses from Ellis, despite many attempts to reach him. Senator Leach has repeatedly denied the allegation against him, and he actually filed a defamation suit against the woman who brought the allegation, as well as some activists who have been involved as well in talking about this allegation.
All right, you broke up just a little bit there. I want to clarify. Leach has filed a defamation lawsuit. Is that correct?
He has. He filed against the woman raising the allegation, as well as some activists who have talked about the allegation.
Okay. To be clear, no criminal charges have been filed against either Ellis or Leach, have they?
Correct.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned in your reporting and just talking with us, leaders have called for them to step down. But what about removing them? I believe you reported that Senator Katie Muth has circulated a letter to the Ethics Committee asking for Leach's expulsion.
She has sent a letter like that. The Senate Ethics Committee operates in almost complete secrecy. Only in very rare cases do the results of their work get publicly released. So I think time will tell whether or not the committee takes action on that. And in the House side, it's also similarly very difficult to try to remove someone from their seat. And I am not aware of any formal efforts to do that.
Okay. Reporter Liz Navratil covers the Capitol for the Post-Gazette and other publications. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The complete split, the end of any relationship between UPMC and Highmark, is just 5 months away. But Allegheny County Comptroller Chelsea Wagner is hoping that it can be averted. She's launched an online petition and is hosting a series of community meetings to heighten public attention. Chelsea Wagner joins us in studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
The relationship between UPMC and Highmark, I mean, it's been crumbling for years. Why do you think it can be salvaged?
Well, when you look at, I think, the timeline when anyone is more apt to do things, and certainly in politics, it is, unfortunately, usually in the 11th hour. And I think during what is upcoming in the next several months, particularly as we approach July 1st, you have about 50,000 seniors in this region that are going to be the next wave of people that are negatively impacted very, very directly by this split. And so I think this is really the moment where, you know, we've reached that point of finality that it is most appropriate for government to finally step in. And I believe this is really incumbent on government. Mm-hmm. It's the leadership that is elected that needs to stop this.
Well, government has stepped in since, and they've gotten some consent decree signed and sort of extended for a while. But that last agreement ends June 30th of this year. A couple of weeks ago, you launched an online portal. It's healthcarepgh.com. to allow residents to urge intervention by state officials. Why do you think state officials will listen? Why do you think Highmark UPMC will listen to people?
Well, I think that number one, people are the stakeholders, and that's one of the things that's been forgotten. I also think it's important to note that it's only the people in the Pittsburgh and Erie markets that are being treated as second-class citizens. And that's something that I realize people that I talk to throughout the county don't necessarily realize, that other people with these plans throughout the state aren't being shuttered from hospitals and doctors in the ways that we are. So I think building that public awareness is important, but I've also had positive response by different state leaders, from legislative leaders to the attorney general and even conversations with the governor. But really, in terms of jurisdiction, it's the attorney general that I believe has the greatest power to act. And I know, and we've had continued conversations with his office, with some of these stories that are on this portal and people who are offering to not just tell us publicly their stories, but communicate with the attorney general's office. So I am very hopeful in that way.
All right. You, as county controller, I mean, you have no jurisdiction, no oversight. So why get involved?
Well, there are two ways that I look at this. Internally, we have employees within my office that are all impacted who have to choose either UPMC or Highmark's plan. Those are the two offered by the county government. And that extends also to the 6,000-some employees within the county government. But then it's also, I think, the largest community issue that's affecting all of the residents within Allegheny County. And I believe that if one individual is not being affected by this now, they will be in the future, because this impacts our entire marketplace.
You mentioned legislative leaders, attorney general, the governor. Legally, do they really have any standing to stop it?
They do, and there are different ways, but that's what is yet to be seen. I am very encouraged that Attorney General Josh Shapiro has been interested in this. And I can tell you, when I talk to people throughout the Commonwealth, they see that this is affecting central Pennsylvania and eastern Pennsylvania more. So I think that's the other part that's building, is that this is not now only a western Pennsylvania problem, but they see that this has impact across the Commonwealth. There are analogous cases in other states where antitrust lawsuits have been brought against similar type entities for this kind of behavior. But then I think most importantly, you have these nonprofit status for these giants. And that to me is really the most egregious thing, because when you look at our residents, we were essentially the angel investors in these healthcare giants. But now as they go and they market this brand internationally, which is a very good brand. Both of these are great healthcare systems. We want to have access to these doctors. But at the end of the day, it's our residents whose tax dollars were used to build these hospitals who are being harmed.
What are we talking about as options? Are we talking antitrust action? Are we talking, I believe Senator Costa has a bill about arbitration.
Right.
And you mentioned the nonprofit, the charitable status. Are all those in play?
I think everything has to be on the table. And I've been supportive in the past of even, say, most recently, city council looking to the building of the new hospitals and what kind of allowances city government would give. So I think as we are in this 11th hour, it's really important to look at all options, because to me, nobody elected UPMC or Highmark to make these decisions. And that's really why we have government, to look at all of these different options and see how we can achieve justice for our residents. Because at the end of the day, our residents are being deprived of their autonomy.
All right. We have just some brief time left. You are hosting, it's a follow-up to this portal, this online petition, if you would, some community meetings. They start Monday. They're going to be held in McKeesport, West Mifflin, the North Hills area, also in East Liberty and Coraopolis, over the course of the next few weeks. What do you hope to get from these community meetings?
Well, I think it's important for residents to have an ability to share their stories, because as I said, we are the stakeholders. It's really the people. It's not the interest of the profits of these two different entities. And I know I gave the example of speaking with Attorney General Josh Shapiro. These stories of how people are really impacted are very helpful to the work that at a minimum, his office will do. But I think likewise, it's important for all the elected officials to hear this. And I think it goes to where many people have been conflicted out, because we know there's a lot of charitable contributions, a lot of business that's passed around by these entities. So giving people this ability, and some people aren't able. We've had requests for anonymity, which we respect certainly on the website. But for people that are able to tell their story, I think it's not just important for that person as an individual, but it really helps us as a larger community.
And very briefly, they can find all the list of where these meetings are on your website?
Yes, on healthcarepgh.com.
Very good. Chelsea Wagner is the Allegheny County Controller. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A little over a month ago, legalized sports betting came to Pennsylvania. Sunday will be the first Super Bowl that people can bet on in the Commonwealth. Jessica Wellman is editor-in-chief at Play Pennsylvania. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Jessica, before we get to the big game Sunday, how's the response been so far in the first several weeks of legalized sports gambling in Pennsylvania?
It's off to a really strong start. We don't have numbers for January yet, but going through the end of the year, where there was a sports book in Pittsburgh with Rivers, in Philadelphia with Sugar House, and Hollywood Casino in Grantville as well, they brought in $16 million in bets over the course of December and made $2 million in revenue. And now that Pennsylvania has four sports books in Philadelphia alone, this month was a lot of fun, especially because some of those sports books launched in time to get those Eagles playoff games and the experience of being able to be in Philadelphia rooting for the game and have money on it was something that people really enjoyed.
The revenue figure that you cited, is that for the sports books, the casinos, or is that what the state's take was?
That is for the revenue for the casinos. So that evens out to about $2 million in profit across the three. And then 34% of that will go into taxes that go to the state.
According to the American Gaming Commission, 1 in 10 Americans will place a wager on the Super Bowl. Is this the biggest single event, single contest as far as wagering goes? Or what about the NCAA basketball tournament, which is multiple games?
For just betting in general, Super Bowl is always going to be the biggest betting day of the year. And that number you cited, it's true, but you also have to keep in mind, I think everyone's been to a Super Bowl party where you play Super Bowl squares or, you know, do little bets with your friends. And I think that the AGA with that number tries to encompass that in there as well versus just people who are actually going to a sports book and placing money.
Do you sense sort of an excitement? How's the average person liking this idea of being able to legally bet on sports in Pennsylvania?
I can tell from our site that it's really all our readers want to talk about. I cannot write enough about sports betting and what's going on. If there's a downside to it, it's that they're getting a little impatient because we do have sports books. They're great. You can go in there, you can bet, you can watch. But what's missing still is that online piece of it, which is coming very, very soon, where you're going to be able to bet on your phone, where you can be at your Super Bowl party with your friends in someone's living room and betting versus having to physically make the trip to the casino.
Will this just be a matter of convenience, or do you think we'll actually increase the total money wagered?
Oh, online, it will make it enormous. To give you an example, in New Jersey, last month they did $330 million in bets. They're a little further along than we are in Pennsylvania. They got their stuff up and running back at the beginning of football season. But of that, roughly 70% comes from online betting. Once Pennsylvania, I would say in 6 months probably, you'll see that mobile betting and online betting will make and bring in way more bets.
Give us a sense for people who don't. Is football the biggest, or is there another sport that overall, maybe across the country, draws in even more action?
Nothing is like football. It's so much bigger. If you look at the numbers in places like Nevada, where that have been doing this for years, football season is the bread and butter of sports books. It's far and away the biggest, but there are other ones that are hockey is getting to be a lot more popular to bet on. Maybe that's in part because Las Vegas had a very good hockey team last year, but NBA as well. You know, it's picking up steam, but I don't think anybody's catching football anytime soon.
Okay. A lot of people know that the point spread, you bet one way or another, or you can bet over or under the total points scored. But are Pennsylvania books or Pennsylvania casinos, are they taking what's known as the prop bets, you know, somebody catching the first touchdown or something like that? Are they taking those bets as well?
They will be, absolutely. There are definitely dozens, if not hundreds, of bets that you can make on the Super Bowl at your Pennsylvania sports books. Things like how many touchdowns Tom Brady will score, over under number of yards for Todd Gurley, will the score end in an even or odd number, things like that. They will all be available. What won't be, to be clear, is you're not going to be able to bet on what color the Gatorade is, or whether or not Maroon 5 has Beyonce come on stage during the halftime show. Those are at some offshore, dubious kinds of books that are not regulated by the United States. Regulated markets in the U.S., they're not going to do those.
Okay. So Pennsylvania was one of the early states to jump on board the legalized sports betting following a Supreme Court decision. I understand that another two dozen states will at least be looking at legislation this year during 2019 to maybe they've seen what revenues are possible.
Absolutely. We ended 2018 with eight states with sports betting operational. Arkansas has already passed something. New York yesterday just adopted some regulations for sports betting, which is going to be it's going to be like Pennsylvania. It's a big state, big population, big sports fans. That's going to be huge. And the states I've heard kind of blow my mind. I think I saw a headline about Alaska looking into sports betting yesterday, South Dakota, Tennessee, Kentucky. I mean, Tennessee, the city of Memphis is looking into whether or not they can bring sports books to Beale Street.
Oh, my.
So I think everybody is seeing that this is a way to generate money for your state, in addition to bringing something that people do enjoy doing to the state. And, you know, it can be hundreds of millions of dollars for the states. So it's big money, and it's drawing a lot of interest for that reason.
And a few of the states you mentioned, they don't even have pro sports teams.
They don't even have pro sports teams. Moreover, they don't even have casinos. You know, there's not a casino in Alaska. There's not a casino in Tennessee, for that matter. The fun thing for my end as a reporter is that you get to see each of these different states coming up with kind of new and interesting ways to do sports betting. And not everybody is adopting this Vegas model like Pennsylvania did.
All right, Jessica, finally, I'm not going to ask you if you are, but if you were to put a wager on the Super Bowl, might I inquire on whom, on what?
I may or may not have put a little money on Rams +3 when it was available for just a few minutes. It was open, and I snuck in there and got, I think, $20. I don't go big, but I just like having a few bucks on the game just to make it interesting.
Jessica Wellman is editor-in-chief at Play Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Jessica, for joining us.
Anytime.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week in the Pittsburgh region, temperatures dip below zero with wind chills more than 20 below. It was even colder in other parts of the Mid-Atlantic and Midwest. That led to a lot of people cranking up the heat and, as a result, increasing demand on our shared power grid. Amy Sisk is WESA state impact reporter covering energy and the environment. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. So how great was the demand? Did we set a record? Were we close to the record?
So we got pretty close to the record, did not quite hit the record. So a little bit of background. PJM is the region's grid operator.
Right.
And so PJM runs the electric power grid in this 13-state territory, which includes Pennsylvania. And they have this super important job of making sure that the supply of electricity from coal plants, gas plants, wind farms is always meeting the demand. So a couple numbers that they gave to me yesterday, they said that Thursday morning, yesterday morning, the peak demand was 139,000 megawatts of power. It's not quite the record. The record was set back in February of 2015. It was 143,000 megawatts of power.
Mm-hmm. So they always say records are made to be broken, but I guess they're not in favor of breaking records at the grid operator.
Not this time around.
Okay. So were they ready, though, for a record?
Yeah, I think so, because they didn't experience any major issues this time around when we had close to a record. And if ever they get close to those record levels, they have something called peaker plants, which mm-hmm. can fire up. So those are gas plants or oil power plants that can fire up kind of at the last minute if needed. They're very expensive to run, and so most of the time they don't operate. But that's sort of a last resort. And a couple of them fired up this time around, but they didn't have to rely on many of them.
So sort of their safety net.
Exactly.
Okay. What impact, if any, did the closing of schools, maybe some government offices, county courts closed, did that have on the energy demand?
Yeah, so those closures were pretty widespread, not just here in Pittsburgh and western Pennsylvania, but all across the Mid-Atlantic and the Midwest. And that's what PJM told me was probably the reason why we did not hit a record, because they were expecting that we might.
Mm-hmm. So other than the actual demand for power, is the system itself affected by the cold weather?
Yes, it can be. So this was particularly problematic back in 2014 when we had the polar vortex back then. And what happened was that there was oftentimes equipment that was like sensitive equipment that was exposed to the elements back then. And because of the cold weather, that ended up knocking or damaging some of that equipment and knocking some of those power generators offline. So at one point back then, there were 22% of power generators, you know, gas plants, wind farms, things like that were not functioning. And that was quite problematic and stressing for the grid. This time around, this week, about 9% were offline at one point. And what's typical is about 6%.
On the natural gas side of things, has the cold weather affected the production of natural gas?
It has a little bit. So I was talking with an analyst from IHS Market who sort of watches natural gas markets. And what he told me was that we experienced something here in the Marcellus Shale region called freeze-offs when it gets to be really, really cold. And so what happens is that the pipelines that are really close to natural gas wells get so cold that natural gas has a hard time flowing through them. And so operators will have to actually bring in like heaters or some sort of insulation to try to address that. So he said that we would expect about 4 to 5%, the production would be down about 4 to 5%. But, you know, just for a short period of time, it's going to warm back up. And so things will probably return back to normal pretty quickly.
All right. So difficulties, does that translate into price affecting prices?
It can, yes. Here in the Pittsburgh area, we're a bit insulated compared to other parts of the nation where they don't produce natural gas, just because we have so much natural gas production here in this area. But just because the wholesale price of natural gas goes up doesn't mean that the retail price that I pay to my natural gas utility, that you pay to your natural gas utility, is necessarily going to go up, because those prices tend to lag behind the wholesale prices. Plus, retail prices are affected by state regulators as well, and so you can't just increase it.
So, some problems in other parts of the country were worse. The cold was worse, including Michigan. Did we have any real problems here?
You know, nothing that I'm aware of. Over in Michigan, there was a fire at a natural gas compressor station, and so the gas utility there had asked people to keep their heat to a maximum of 65 degrees in their homes and their businesses, but nothing like that here.
Final question. So what's next for the power grid as the weather warms up?
You know, things should be returning back to normal. Some units will go down for maintenance to get ready for the next cold spell, and hopefully be ready to fire back up then.
Amy Sisk is WESA State Impact Reporter covering energy and the environment. Amy, thanks so much for sitting down with us.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pennsylvania is surrounded by states with higher minimum wages, as much as $3.85 more per hour. Governor Wolf has again proposed boosting Pennsylvania's minimum wage, but will it have any more success than the previous 4 attempts that failed? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lunigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.